Good morning. First case this morning will be United States versus Jerry Jarrett. Mr. Holler.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. As the District Court stated on page 30 of its opinion, the only issue before the Court is whether the defendant was prosecuted solely for the vindictive purpose of preventing him from continuing to represent his client, Dr. Zhang Baek. The federal government's decision to bring a prosecution is entitled to a presumption of regularity, and a defendant claiming vindictive prosecution must present clear evidence of an improper motive. The District Court's decision is rife with factual errors, and reviewing that decision, this Court should not allow it to stand. The District Court found that the government prosecuted Mr. Jarrett solely to penalize him for filing motions to disclose expert reports in a state court murder case against Dr. Baek and to interfere with a later filed federal drug prosecution. But the evidence simply does not support that claim. For example, the District Court finds that the actions of the United States government are shown by the fact that it failed to file conflict of interest motions in other cases, but did in the Baek case. But that's a factual error. The government filed conflict of interest notices in all three cases where Mr. Jarrett represented defendants after it was determined that he was a target of a federal investigation.
Mr. Holler, one of the things that seems to have bothered the District Court is that the government apparently had, at least what the District Court thought, was everything it needed to prosecute Mr. Jarrett back around 1999, and yet somehow or another it happened to do so after Mr. Good, and actually it seems to have had some problems with the way Mr. Good was approached even. You might want to address that.
Well, Your Honor, the government offered its reason and explained why it did what it did. Mr. Good was approached when he was charged with a federal crime in late 2000. A proffer was held, and the District Court seemed to say once the government had that proffer in hand, it should have gone forward and should have charged its case if it was going to charge it. But the proffer is not evidence. The live witness is the evidence. And Mr. Good was not willing to cooperate with the government. Mr. Good said he was going to go to trial. He was innocent of the charges against him. So he was not available as a witness to be used against Mr. Jarrett.
Now later on, did you tell the District Court that it was the government that approached Mr. Good after Mr. Vincent was representing him, or did you just say he decided to come forward, or what was said?
The exact wording of the motion was simply that Mr. Good decided to cooperate with the government. That was what was stated in the initial motion. Admittedly, Your Honor, it could have been clearer that it was the government that approached Mr. Vincent. But you have to step back, as I pointed out in my reply brief, and understand what was going on at the time. In response to the initial motion that was filed by Mr. Jarrett and his counsel stated, the government, in April of 2003, I, Mr. Jarrett, got the state murder charges dismissed. And suddenly in May 2003, with no action having occurred at any point in time, the government indicts me. To some people, that might look suspicious. But the point was, as the government pointed out, it wasn't as if the government took a dead case suddenly in late April of 2003 and decided, you know what, we're upset with this guy, let's charge him. Instead, the government had decided long before, we're going to pursue this case, we're going to approach Mr. Good. It has nothing to do with anything that occurred in April because Mr. Vincent was approached in January. So that was the point. The point was Mr. Good's already decided to cooperate. The IRS has already started working on making its final report, the internal agency reports that simply have to be done before the U.S. Attorney's Office prosecutes a case. So there wasn't any intention at all to mislead the court. If the court was misled, it's simply because of the way the case subsequently developed. The way the case subsequently developed was Mr. Jarrett retreated from the track of it was the dismissal in April that motivated the government, and now it's something that occurred prior to January that motivated the government. And once you step back, what in the government's opinion is a circumspect or difficult to believe proposition becomes an impossible one, that because of some filing of some state court motion to disclose expert reports, the government is now deciding to vindictively prosecute Mr. Jarrett. It just doesn't make any sense. The state expert didn't make a determination that he couldn't prove the state murder case until March of 2003.
The thing that strikes me so odd about this case that is the district court judge writes a really long opinion about this, 38 pages long, and he acknowledges in the course of that opinion that it's an extremely unusual thing. Indeed, I think he says that he can't find a single court of appeals case that has ever upheld a dismissal for a dismissal of an indictment for vindictive prosecution. And yet something is in there that makes the judge feel that this is that case, that this is the case. And I think one gets the sense that he feels that the government has somehow been playing fast and loose, either with him or with Mr. Jarrett or with someone.
I recognize that, Your Honor, and certainly that sense does pervade the district court's opinion. But I think if one looks at the opinion, at the point, the district court wrote an opinion before trial. This issue was fully briefed before the trial, and the district court says, "I accept the government's explanation. They approached Gregory Good, and they find Gregory Good. That's the explanation." What I think the district court might be doing, and I don't really want to speculate about that, since I think speculating on motives is kind of why we're here in the first place, but it seems what the district court says is, "I heard Gregory Good sitting on the witness stand, and I don't believe him. And if I were the U.S. Attorney's Office, I would not have believed that witness, and therefore the explanation that I accepted pretrial can't be the real one." And I think that seems to be what the district court is saying. If one reads his opinion, he states, "Had I known before trial what Gregory Good was going to sound like on the witness stand, and had I known that there was this proffer that occurred in 2000, I would not have ruled the way that I did." But that's not the right way to look at the case, Your Honor, because, first of all, the way that a witness appears on the witness stand is not necessarily the way that a witness appeared before the grand jury or appeared in interviews anyway. So one can't base one's conclusion based on the way one performed on the witness stand. Mr. Jarrett is a very good lawyer, and I have no doubt, I was not present at the trial, but I have no doubt that Mr. Jarrett made Gregory Good look like not the best witness in the world. The district court says that. He thought he was one of the worst witnesses in the world. But that doesn't mean that he was a bad witness in the grand jury. It doesn't mean that he was a bad witness in pretrial preparation. And the other point, the district court relies on the fact that this proffer existed, that he didn't know there was this December of 2000 proffer. And that, again, seems to be a misunderstanding of the nature of a proffer or of something like that. It's not like when that proffer was had that Mr. Good was a witness in hand. We couldn't have introduced the proffer at trial and said, "Here's what Gregory Good would say."
So what's the usual practice in disclosing the warts of a witness to the grand jury? In other words, telling the grand jury here that Good had this Rule 35 motion pending, other problems on as far as his credibility is concerned, that he had made a prior proffer that no one believed.
I don't know if there is a usual practice, Your Honor. I don't. There isn't a set practice.
Well, what does the manual say?
The manual says that. Essentially, Brady material must be disclosed to the grand jury. Substantial exculpatory evidence must be disclosed to the grand jury. Whether this is substantial exculpatory evidence or not is essentially determination of the individual assistant United States attorney. There were warts disclosed. Gregory Good testified in his prison suit. They knew that he was a criminal. They knew that he was coming in and testifying with less than perfect credibility. But keep in mind again, Your Honor, all of these warts were exposed to the trial jury. Every single last one of these warts was exposed to the trial jury about what a terrible person Gregory Good was, about how much incentive he had to lie, about how he had made earlier statements in a proffer. And the jury in 2 hours convicted of all counts involving Gregory Good. So it's hard to believe that the grand jury would have approached this case any differently had the government gone through every single one of the things that Mr. Jarrett has asked for. The district court doesn't rely particularly heavily on that. He says that there was a lack of candor to the grand jury, but the government did make disclosures to the grand jury, and the government
just
was in this case.
Well, that's just one of the things he points to as evidence of vindictiveness on the part of the government.
That's true, Your Honor, but unless there's evidence that the government always discloses these things and failed to do that here, it's hard to believe.
Well, that's why I asked you. What is the usual practice?
I think it's left to the assistant.
The individual assistant United States attorney and what they're going to tell the grand jurors?
In terms of what's in the United States attorney's manual, it only states that substantial exculpatory evidence, evidence of innocence, Brady material must be disclosed. It doesn't really state that any Giglio material must be disclosed, and that's the evidence in the record. The U.S. Attorney's Manual, Chapter 9 on grand jury, was filed by Mr. Jarrett with the court. So that is the evidence. But even stepping back from that, Your Honor, again, if the government failed to follow an internal manual, then that system will be dealt with internally by the government. The question is whether the courts should step in and dismiss the indictment of someone who's been convicted of a federal crime because of some failing by an assistant United States attorney, if that's even what it was. I mean, looking at this logically, if the government had exposed every single one of these warts to the grand jury, if the assistant had done that, there's still probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. It's hard to believe that the grand jury would not have returned a valid indictment. So where in the government's mind are they... How is it logical to believe that the government, as part of its intent and purpose to get Mr. Jarrett off the case, is failing to disclose these items? It's not logically sound to make that argument.
The judges Lozano and Moody recuse, is that right, from this case? Or at some point?
No, this they were never assigned to the case of U.S. versus Jarrett. There's obviously multiple cases that are flowing through here. The Beck case was initially assigned to Judge Lozano. It then went to Judge Moody because Judge Lozano recused for reasons completely unrelated to this case. Judge Moody recused, and the Beck case went to Judge Sharp.
So it was the Beck case then.
This case, I believe this case was very briefly assigned to Judge Springman in the Fort Wayne Division and was then reassigned to Judge Lee. At the time, there was an overflow of cases in Hammond, and some cases were being assigned to South Bend and Fort Wayne. I don't believe, at least to my knowledge, there's no public record that this case was ever assigned to Judge Lozano or Judge Moody, and they've accused.
Well, I guess the reason I focus on that is because then Judge Lee, he would, and you know, I'm just guessing, but he would be less familiar, if maybe not familiar at all, with the U.S. attorneys over here.
That's correct. Judge Lee did come to Hammond and did try this case, but he's, to my knowledge, has never tried any other case involving Hammond assistants.
I wonder if there was some basis that maybe he was didn't have the trust or knowledge or know the background of these people to, and whereas if he'd tried a case for a lot of them, he'd already know their credibility and their consistency. Was there anything like that that filtered through this trial? That maybe a lack of knowledge or maybe a misunderstanding or something that because of his lack of familiarity with them?
The only thing that I would reflect upon that might reflect a lack of knowledge on Judge Lee's part, just simple lack of familiarity, I think in the Hammond Division with the GRIT task force, with some of the problems that the Drug Division has had with Gary prosecutions, we're more apt to give Rule 35 motions. We're more apt to do those things than the Fort Wayne Division has been, which tend to be more single-hit drug dealer-type cases. The district court, for example, seems to cite the Brookshire case where a Rule 35 motion was granted as evidence that Mr. Jarrett is a powerful and successful defense attorney that the government would want off the case. And I just don't know under what basis one could think that, other than I think the practice in our district, there are less of those that are given in the Fort Wayne Division, and so for one to be given would probably show some a special skill on the part of a member of the Fort Wayne Defense Bar. In general, I don't know your Honor. He is to some extent a visiting judge to the Hammond Division for this case, but the overall purpose simply is looking at the facts and looking at the evidence. There's no objective evidence, certainly not enough to overcome the presumption that this prosecution was brought vindictively. I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Okay.
To reserve the balance.
Thanks, Mr. Jarrett.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the Court. Counsel for the government seems to suggest that Judge Lee was not familiar with or may not have been familiar with the prosecution team in the case that was presented against myself. I would point out to the Court that Ms. Johnson, Assistant U.S. Attorney Sharon Johnson, who tried the case, the charge against me, had recently tried a case in Fort Wayne and was very familiar with Judge Lee. And I don't believe if there was any issue as to whether or not these prosecutors were not known to Judge Lee. Judge Lee was looking at the facts. If the court, as the court, as I'm sure, has done, will review the original order that Judge Lee entered, denying our original motion to dismiss for on the basis of indicative prosecution, the court will see that he gave tremendous deference to what the prosecution team had told him up till that time. But what was so unbelievable is the only word I can really think of, Your Honor, to describe the situation. So unbelievable is that the lack of candor that the prosecution team had to the court prior to the trial.
But Mr. Jarrett, I guess what I'm interested in is a couple of things. But one of them is what changed between that initial ruling of the district court and the post-trial ruling, other than Mr. Good's performance on the stand?
Oh, tremendous. There were several things that changed. We found out during the course of the trial that there was other exculpatory evidence that the prosecution had that it had not turned over to the defense. Proffer letters of a Mr. Rapole, who was the other cooperating witness on behalf of the government in this particular case. There was
But you're not making a Brady argument in this court.
No, Your Honor. No, but I'm asking the
I don't remember seeing that in your brief that because you emphasized the things that had been presented or not presented before the grand jury, but you're now saying that there was Brady material that came about during the trial that you didn't get?
No, Your Honor, no. That's not what I'm suggesting. It's not a Brady argument. Remember the
but
issue.
Okay, so you're saying that you found out during the trial that the grand jury hadn't heard about other impeaching material about the witnesses?
We found out a lot of that's one of the things. We found out that the grand jury was not provided with the testimony that I had given to the previous grand jury surrounding these same circumstances, these so-called money laundering transactions, which were in essence investments made by these individuals into a company that I was operating at the time.
Right, and why did it have to be given that material? Under what legal standard?
Oh, Your Honor, again, it's not an issue of whether it had to be given.
Well, it is partly an issue, because if the government was under no duty to give it, then the fact that the government didn't give it, it stands in a different light than if the government was under a duty to give it.
Yeah, I apologize, Your Honor. I was assuming you were tying that question to the question about Brady. And I was suggesting that there wasn't any Brady issue raised as to why I should have been given that or wouldn't have been given that prior to trial. But you're right. There was an issue as to, and it comes from the United States Attorney's Manual, that says that the government must present any substantial exculpatory evidence to the grand jury, which my testimony before the previous grand jury was substantial exculpatory evidence, because I denied, as I have always denied and continue to deny today, that I had any knowledge that what the money that they were giving to me was, in fact, drug money or money that was obtained through drug trafficking.
No, I understand that. Well, go ahead, Jim.
So one of the problems, I think, here is that you ordinarily think of the grand jury as being concerned only with probable cause, pretty low threshold. And here we have a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt by a trial jury. Ordinarily, then, any problems that developed in the probable cause stage of the proceedings are not particularly material, as in your case, where there's a finding of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by a trial jury.
Right. And Your Honor, as we know,
you make a lot about these the government not producing or calling the grand jury's attention to some of these problems. But what difference does that make if there's a finding beyond a reasonable doubt by a trial jury where all these issues could have been explored and were explored?
Well, and you're right, Your Honor. Under the complete, on the abstract view of looking at this case from a pure conviction standpoint and challenging the validity of the jury verdicts or the finding of guilt, that would seem to preclude the issue of looking into what was provided and what was not provided to the grand jury. But that is not the posture of this case. And I think Judge Lee said it better than I could say it myself. Had he been advised of the things that were done by the government in obtaining this indictment, as well as the underlying things regarding Good, because it wasn't just Mr. Good's testimony that concerned him, it was the entire posture of how this case became an indictment against me after we had obtained substantial success in my representation of Dr. John Beck in the federal court in the state court in Lake County, Indiana. And it is that which makes these instances of failure to provide substantial exculpatory evidence to the grand jury, or the failure to expose all of those things that might allow the prosecution or the grand jury to make a determination of guilt, or excuse me, whether or not an indictment should be handed down, those are the things that suggest that the prosecution was in fact motivated by something other than simply bringing an indictment against someone they believe to have been involved in criminal activity.
But Mr. Jarrett, you've been stressing for the last couple of minutes how important, in fact, your knowledge of what lay behind these transactions was. And that's precisely the reason the government states for waiting and not bringing the indictment down in 1999 or 2000, but instead waiting until they have Mr. Good corroborating other evidence that you knew what was going on. I mean, knowledge is not the easiest thing in the world to prove. And so the government waits, and their argument is, in the exercise of their prosecutorial discretion, starting in January of 2003, they finally think, you know, this case is going to come together. And when you take that along with the benefit of the doubt you give the prosecutor and the fact that judges aren't the ones making prosecutorial decisions, it seems to me your argument supports the government.
No, it does not, Your Honor, because my argument is not that they should have waited to obtain this information before they bring the necessary charges or convene the grand jury. My argument is that they sought out this information to make this case that they thought that they had at a time when they knew that it would be an opportunity to interfere with the representation of Dr. Jean Beck. Because
but why
that was
would
their
it have
motivation.
Done that in January? That's when they approached Mr. Good. And the expert, I mean, why isn't it just as plausible to think that once the state's expert in the Beck case comes out and says there's no causation that we can prove, that the only thing for the state to do was dismiss that?
Your Honor, as I indicated in my brief, the state's case against Dr. Beck involving the felony murder, that case was unraveling back in October of 2002 when I first filed my motion to obtain this information. I had reason to believe that the government, along with the state prosecutor, was very much aware of the fact that they were not going to be able to prove causation, and they stalled on presenting these reports for almost 4 months.
But the word they is a big word. It's the state that had the obligation, not the U.S. Attorney's Office.
But, Your Honor, we'll see, and I think we've shown an interwoven, as far as the Beck case is concerned, a relationship between the government prosecutors in my case, and the state prosecutors, both of them having been involved in a joint investigation of Dr. Beck with many, many man hours spent in that investigation. And then them deciding that they would let the state case go first. And then and the court will even recall at one point in time in the Beck case, the federal government dismissed its criminal complaint against Dr. Beck, saying that they would, so that the state prosecution would be allowed to go unhindered. And then, and it was during that process that the state's case, as far as the murder charges, was unraveling and was about to go south.
Why would the federal government care about that, since they could and in fact did simply re-indict? It's not like there was a statute of limitations problem.
I don't think they cared necessarily, Your Honor, about when the case became when the case was dismissed. I think they cared about the fact that the posture of the case and the fact that the evidence against Dr. Beck was not only shaky in the felony murder case, but also in the dealing cases that were going to be prosecuted in either in the state case or in the federal court. And if I could, Your Honor, point out, there was a 16 or 18 month investigation of Dr. Beck by these same entities prior to them starting the investigation in 2002 that led to the charges that he faced. And after that first round of investigations, which was almost a mirror of the subsequent investigation, they made a determination that there was insufficient evidence to prosecute Dr. Beck. Then, lo and behold, after the second investigation is begun of Dr. Beck, which was precipitated by an overdose of a person who was closely related to one of the state prosecutors, after that, they came back and essentially used the same type of evidence to indict Dr. Beck and to charge him with murder. And it was my intent to show, as you know, had I've tried the case, that that the same evidence that the government had looked at and determined was insufficient was the same evidence that they were going to be relying upon to prosecute Dr. Beck, and to show that this was more than there was more than a reasonable doubt as to whether or not he had committed any crimes. And I'm not for one minute saying that I'm the only attorney that could have represented Dr. Beck, or that even if I know that we would have won the case. I'm not suggesting that. But I know that I would have put up a fierce opposition to what the government was planning to do to Dr. Beck and what they eventually did to him.
Now, but for the Beck case, the process that the government followed, would that be a normal procedure if otherwise? Do you understand what I mean? Obviously, the Beck case weighs heavily on this as far as you're concerned.
Right.
But the process that they follow, the delay, waiting to get Good in position where he'd testify and all that sort of thing, would that have been a normal procedure in this district?
If it was simply just the passage of time, Your Honor, that for an indictment to have been returned, I would think that the statute of limitations would provide that there's no that the defendant, myself, I would have had no legal argument to stand upon as long as they bring it within the statute of limitations. But here we're talking about them not just bringing it within the statute of limitations, which they did, but they brought it for the improper motive. And that's what we're looking at. And that's what was established by everything that was pointed out to Judge Lee, which he made findings upon, which the state, which the government cannot produce any evidence of clear error.
He made some mistakes in those.
If the government had returned, or the grand jury had returned a sealed indictment against you and kept it under seal until the Beck case ran its course, then you wouldn't have any complaint here, would you?
Your Honor, I would not have a complaint right now if they would not have set up the through the circumstances and through the scenario that has been presented, if they would have allowed the prosecution to just simply take its course. But they made a specific attack to try to get me out of the Beck case. That was their whole point and motive. The timing, along with what was done and said to Judge Lozano at that conflict of interest hearing, was designed to interfere with my representation of Dr. Beck. And to suggest that Judge Lee is wrong because he did not say that the government had filed, or did not find that the government had filed conflict of interest notices against me in other cases, is not accurate, because what Judge Lee is referring to is whether or not they filed conflict of interest notices prior to the Beck case ever coming on the horizon. Because I represented other defendants in the Northern District of Indiana. And the government, during that same period of time, never determined or said that I was I had a conflict of interest and I could not or should not be representing any of those other defendants. I was targeted because of Mr. Beck.
Okay,
and
Mr.
And I see
Jarrett.
My time is up.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Holler. You've got about a minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. I guess briefly, the only thing I really want to add is just the federal government filed a complaint, and based on that complaint, froze Dr. Beck's assets, later instituted a civil forfeiture proceeding, was able to do restrain those assets and accomplish many of its goals while all of this supposedly was going on. The murder case is much harder than the drug case. The drug case, you have to prove that he was dealing drugs illegally through his clinic, and then to prove the murder case, you have to prove that the drugs that he dealt caused somebody's death. So the fact that the state couldn't prove its murder case has nothing to do with whether the federal government is going to prove its drug case.
An easier prosecution, in other words.
It is an easier prosecution. And while the state was having troubles with its prosecution, the federal government had its forfeiture proceeding moving right along. There was no problem. Mr. Jarrett was representing him on that as well. The government waited. The government, was referring to the Hubbard case in deciding what it was going to do. And this was still obviously an important matter to figure out what to do when you're indicting a defense attorney. But the Hubbard case essentially states investigation of a defense attorney is not enough, but once they're essentially a target of an investigation, you need to have a conflict hearing. You need to let everybody know in a sealed proceeding. I mean, this was not made public until after he was in fact indicted. But they had to let everyone know what was going on. At the conflict hearing, the assistant United States attorney essentially leaves the matter up to the court until independent counsel steps in and says, I'm really worried that Dr. Beck doesn't understand what he's doing and is waiving his Sixth Amendment rights. So at that point, the government has a responsibility to step in and to act. I don't think that there's any evidence from that, though the district court relies on it, that this was some vindictive motive. The filing of a conflict notice flows from fact that there's probable cause to indict and, in fact, evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of this man's guilt, not the other way around.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
This case will be taken under advisement.